The Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Finalist Season continues this Saturday, March 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. This is Phil Davidson. Joining me today is Music Director Finalist Andrew Krust, who will be presenting Rachmaninoff and the Hollywood Sound this Saturday. Welcome to Rockford.
It's great to be here, Phil.
Did I pronounce your last name right?
That's exactly right.
I wasn't sure, so I'm glad I did. Well, let's begin by hearing something about you. Where you're from, what you have been doing in the musical world, and anything else you'd like to tell us.
Yes, this question. Well, I'm from Kansas City, so not actually too far from here. Growing up, the nearest big city, I guess, was technically St. Louis, but I would come to Chicago with my family. I have got some family that actually lived here before I was born. So I grew up in the Midwest, but I currently live in Vancouver, where I'm the associate conductor of the Vancouver Symphony. That's in British Columbia, not the one in Washington. And I also am the music director of the Lima Symphony in Ohio, which is also not too terribly far from here. Grew up in Kansas City. I did my undergraduate degree there in Kansas, actually, at Wichita State. I followed a trumpet teacher there. And I did a degree in, it was performance and education, but I really studied everything there was to study. I really had a full absorption in music. I played in the symphony. I played in the band. I played in the jazz band. I was always the second trumpet in the big band, which was the improviser, right? Not the screaming high lead trumpet stuff. I played in an improvisation group that we founded. You know, I did a lot of composing, studied conducting, of course, at some point. And that's when I really kind of realized the path I wanted in my undergrad. I started taking lessons from Mark Laycock. Then I met Yaniv Attar, actually, who was the first finalist, I believe. He's a great friend of mine. And we met in Romania in a small town called Bacău. For a conducting workshop. It was, I think, my first international workshop. And he told me about McGill, which is in Montreal. He had gone there. He had studied conducting there. So if it wasn't for him, I probably would not have ever gone to Canada for school. So I ended up going to McGill, loved it there in Montreal, did my master's there, and then I continued my studies at Colorado Boulder, University of Colorado Boulder, in conducting as well. And so at that point, once you've got all of your degrees and you're sort of patiently waiting until your skills are developed enough to be a conductor, I got my first job with the Portland Symphony in Maine, stayed there for two seasons. Then I was at the Memphis Symphony, and now that was my job. I also ran the Youth Symphony there. And now from there I went to Vancouver, and from Vancouver I went to Lima, and here I am today in Rockford.
Well, I believe you're also a visual artist. Tell us something about, maybe the media you use and the style and how it relates to music.
It's a very fun and engaging. And it's not necessarily a hobby for me anymore because I actually do sell a lot of work, and I never expected that to happen. It was kind of something that just occurred. I doodled every now and then growing up. I never took it seriously. I never took any classes, but I think one time I was in Vienna, I went to the Leopold Museum, and I really like Klimt and Schiele, those Austrian or German, you know, style turn-of-the-century painters, and I just got inspired. I thought, okay, I want to learn how to do this. And I do a lot in watercolors and ink. I started making a lot of music-related drawings that would involve portraits of composers that would somehow incorporate the music itself. But, you know, it's something I don't have much time to do. So I kind of feel like, I mean, I hate to compare myself to Mahler, but he called himself a Sommerkomponist, someone who composed only in the summer when he wasn't conducting. And that happens to me. I go for stretches and do nothing. And then the second I've got a moment to do it, I just endlessly work on projects. And I haven't really figured out how it relates to music, but I will say it's a kind of a flow state. I'll get into making the art and I'll just not stop for hours. And as a conductor, when you're performing, you're in a flow state. But when you're studying, it's hard to get into that. You know, it's because it's all this intellectual activity. There's nothing tactile about it. And so I really enjoy the physical nature of making something, and also completing something, because a conductor never completes anything. You're always learning. I'll study Beethoven 5 until I die. So it offers me something, actually, I think, that music doesn't, which is maybe why I like it.
So what motivated you to reach out to RSO when you heard about the music director opening?
Well, you know, a lot of people apply to this position, and when you first apply, you do a lot of research, and you say, okay, what is this organization all about? I knew a little bit about it because I've got some friends who have played in this orchestra as subs, people who live in Chicago or around the area. But you look for things that are really good signs and things that are in alignment with your personal beliefs about what an orchestra should be. And I saw a lot of really great signs. I saw that the programming was diverse. There were interesting programs such as, you know, Women in Music. You know, there were a lot of forward-thinking social ideas going into the programming. I saw that education was very important. I saw the connection to the Youth Symphony. And I also saw, for example, that the website is available in Spanish, you know, that we're really trying to serve this specific community, because I really believe that an orchestra should be tailor-made to the area in which it exists. And so first and foremost is, are we really reaching out to the community in a meaningful way, or are we just sort of checking off a box and appearing to be community-oriented? And I didn't get that sense when I had a look at this orchestra. And the more research I've done, you know, the staff is just lovely, and they really love music. And having met the orchestra for the first time yesterday, I'm even more inspired. It's a great group, very talented, very friendly and flexible group. So it's also, you know, in close proximity to my other orchestra in Ohio. So it's, I think, a wonderful place for me, and I'm going to keep learning this week. But so far, things look great.
Well, as kind of a tangent to what you were just talking about, we know that the music director plans the concerts and conducts the orchestra. But what other facets of the position do you feel are important as it relates to the symphony organization and the community?
Yeah, I mean, this job, like many leadership jobs, are multifaceted, and I think, not to be, you know, too arrogant, but conducting jobs are probably some of the most complicated. They involve the most different skills. And yes, musicians' side of it, the rehearsals are extremely important. That's the sort of the foundation. But all of that means nothing if you can't get out the message. And so I really feel that a music director is a kind of an advocate for the arts and for composers and for musicians. We live in this time when, you know, people have a diverse array of music at their fingertips through YouTube and Spotify. So in one sense, they can hear any kind of music they want. But in another sense, music participation among people in our country, I haven't studied it. I'm sure someone has. I think it's probably at one of its lowest points in history. That comes from education. That comes from, where do we start in the schools? What does our government consider a priority? It's not the arts, and that's tragic. And we have to realize the government is not going to sponsor orchestras in the same way that they do maybe in Germany or in other places. And so if you believe in the value of the arts, if you believe that they're not just entertainment, which I do and I think most people do, somebody has got to safeguard these things. And I think the artistic leaders in opera companies and museums and ballet companies and theater companies and orchestras, they have to be these people, because nobody else is doing it, right? Obviously, donors are doing it with their dollars, but a music director has to be this person that's out there in the public speaking to as many people as possible, bringing them into our world, because we can't assume that everyone is like us and they know the depth of music history going back to the 1500s. And so you have to convince people that this is worth listening to. Sometimes you have to convince people to listen to music from before they were born. Like, you know, I've met 20-year-olds who don't know anything from the 60s. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, that's only 30 years before you were born, or 40 years. What about the 40s and 50s? What about the 1880s? You know, there's this breadth of knowledge. So I think I know this is valuable for humanity, this music. And so music directors are communicators. And you can't assume people will just show up. You have to bring them into your world. You have to explain. You know, one of the greatest communicators was Bernstein. And even back in the 50s when he was doing these young people's concerts, very different time. The boys were wearing ties, you know, and they're all very attentive. But he could talk to them about Beethoven or Beatles or at the same level. And that's what we need to do today. So there's a lot going on in the music director world, but I think that's the key thing is to be a communicator and to reach out to as many different people as you can.
Well, that's terrific. Okay, so let's talk about Rachmaninoff and the Hollywood sound. Why did you choose this particular program and the title and the pieces that are in the program?
Well, I'm really looking forward to this program. I haven't done anything quite like this, actually. And, you know, film, I've always loved film. I don't know if I'm a bona fide cinephile, but I've seen a lot of movies. And I love learning about directors and of course, the scores. I think, honestly, that may be one of the reasons I was interested in orchestral music, is I watched a lot of great movies, thanks to my parents growing up, and some of these have great orchestral scores. And we don't often put these scores on the same program as, like, a Masterworks kind of concert. You know, they're somehow on a Pops concert, which is crazy, because these composers, especially the ones on this program, a lot of them didn't even consider themselves film composers, or they didn't start that way. They wrote symphonies and operas like Korngold, you know, and this music is absolutely out of that world. And so I think it's a natural fit. I was tasked with creating a program which was kind of multi-genre or bridging the gap between the popular and the classical, and film is a great way to do that. And, of course, Rachmaninoff probably sold more LPs than any other composer of all time. So every time I go to an LP shop, I see about 50 records there of Rachmaninoff, because it bridges that gap. And so I thought, okay, we'll have a nice concerto with a fantastic soloist, but we'll make the link between that sound world of Rachmaninoff, that romantic sound world, and then all of the film scores, which came shortly thereafter. And some of these composers were born or already alive at the time this second concerto was premiered. So I think it's a great connection, and it's kind of going to be a conversational program. I'm going to try and explain some of the links in these sound worlds, but also a bit of the historical side as well. So I'm excited, because I've never conducted any of this film music, and they're scores that I've loved for a very long time.
Well, speaking of great scores and great movies, the first piece is the Casablanca Suite by Max Steiner. Tell us something about Steiner and his background and his career scoring in Hollywood.
So I'm very excited about this piece. It opens the program. I actually conducted the film with orchestra. It was the first film I ever did. So anyone who's conducted a film knows that it's in your blood by the time you're done with it. I think I watched it 30 times in preparation. Classic film. And Steiner, it's great to start a concert with Steiner, because he is called sort of the father of orchestral film music. He was born in 1888 in Austria. He was 12 when Rachmaninoff's second concerto premiered. And he wrote King Kong, which was, I believe, it might have been 33. And that was really the first example of an orchestral original, orchestral film score. And it's funny, he had to convince people that that was valuable. And I think he or someone, I can't remember, it wasn't the studio that paid for the orchestra. And then they heard this score, and suddenly the score was even more sensational than the film. And from that moment on, directors realized the emotional power of having a full orchestral score tailor-made for a film. And so from that moment on, this was the model until, you know, fairly recently, actually. So really powerful composer in that world. He also used this Wagnerian technique of leitmotif. So in a Wagnerian opera, you might have every character would have a distinct theme. If you think about Star Wars, every character has a theme, from Darth Vader to Leia to Yoda. And that was used already in these King Kong films. Williams uses it, I think, in just about everything. Mm-hmm. You know, the shark has a theme in Jaws, even. Mm-hmm. So that, I think music evolves when you're thinking of what what can be new in music, going back to the earliest recorded music in the 1500s and 1600s, there was this vast landscape of newness. Even adding harmony to music instead of singing it in unison was new. But the closer you get to today, the sharper that corner is, and the fewer chances there are to be new. So film was a new technology, right? And I think that's one way to be new. Electronic music, that kind of stuff. But film opened this massive gateway for new music. And I think it's just one of the most powerful marriages of two medias. And this is a great film. He wrote over 300 film scores. And this is, I think, probably one of his most famous.
Well, now, I believe I read that there are a lot of different musical themes in this music. Can you give us a description of what we'll hear, and also the situation with the actual theme song that people know so well and his tie with that?
Right. So as time goes by is what you're referring to. And of course, there's the famous line, "Play it again, Sam," which, by the way, is not the line. It's "Play it once, Sam." I know this because I've seen the film 30 times. And that, it's funny, that song, when Steiner was asked to score this film, he asked if he could leave that out. He didn't really want to deal with that song. But the director said, sorry, it's an integral part of this film. So he said, fine, and he actually put it into his score, right? So it's that piece of music not only is played at the piano by Sam very often, it's all over the score. And that song represents Rick and Ilsa's ill-fated love that started in Paris and was destroyed by the war. And now they're being reconnected. And, of course, Rick, it's a painful song for him to hear. And there's a great scene in Casablanca where, well, Ilsa's back, and she says, "Play it once, Sam," instead of "Play it again, Sam." And he does, and Rick is, he doesn't want to hear it. He gets frustrated because it's too painful for him. So I think it's a great example, maybe one of the first examples of a song being deeply tied into the structure of a film itself. So you hear that. You hear La Marseillaise, which this whole thing is about clash between, you know, Germans and the Allies and all of these things. And so there's a great scene in this bar, in Rick's bar, where a bunch of Germans start singing a German song. And then everyone else in the bar, in the same rhythm, starts singing La Marseillaise, and it becomes this battle, and the Germans are just drowned out entirely. It's a great moment. Very hard to accompany that when you're conducting it, because there are two songs going on at once. They're changing the tempo all the time. When the orchestra's playing La Marseillaise, you hear nothing of the singing, so I had to just watch their mouths moving. But that's one of the things you're going to hear. You also hear Steiner trying to have a vaguely Moroccan or Middle Eastern sort of sound. So you hear the oboe, maybe what you might call in previous days sort of the snake charmer music, which, of course, not actually how music sounded there, perhaps, but it's definitely how an Austrian might have thought it sounded. So you've got the tam-tams and the finger cymbals and then all of this lush, gorgeous string writing. It's really a diverse film, and that theme that, as time goes by, gets twisted in all different ways. And so in some moments it's lush and romantic and nostalgic, and other moments it's very, very painful. So it's, I think it's a nice fertile theme that he could use to whatever method he wanted.
Well, then we move on to another movie where the music is, well, one of the stars, really, and that's the suite from Psycho. And is it Herman or is it Hermann? Or?
Well, I mean, he was born in the U.S., so we'll say Herman.
Okay. He went on to become an in-demand composer for radio, movies, TV. Who were some of the famous directors and writers with whom he collaborated on scores?
Well, many. François Truffaut, for example, from the French New Wave. Orson Welles, and of course, I mean, I rewatched recently last week Scorsese's Taxi Driver, mm-hmm. and then of course Hitchcock, many many Hitchcock films, and so he had a large range. I think he lived quite a while as well. So he he had a chance to work with a lot of great directors. I think they wanted to work with him, too. And he had a great stylistic range as well.
So now, again, I'll repeat what I said. Anyone who's seen Psycho knows that the music is an integral part, particularly in the scariest parts. So describe for us again what we'll hear, and we're gonna have to be ready for some cold chills here?
Probably. I mean, it's a visceral experience, and it brings you right back to that those scenes. Even if you haven't seen the film, I feel like the shower scene is a part of our culture. Everybody knows. You see a clip from that. Everyone knows what that's from. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's also one of the most famous segments in music. You know, you think of Jaws. If you just hum that, people know what that is. You can't really hum the shower scene, but everybody knows what it is because it's been used and reused and parodied. And that's actually a compliment, right? It's an extremely effective sound. And it's like, I mean, the music is imitating a knife stabbing flesh. It's terrifying. And, of course, that's not how this score opens, actually. It opens with a different scene, which has been stuck in my head for weeks, actually. Not any of this gorgeous, lush music, but this really tense music when the main character is driving around in the rain and she can barely see and her wipers aren't properly working, and it's this fast and just gives you all of this crazy energy and sort of fear for what's to come. But it's also a very I would say almost impressionistic score. It's describing a dismal swamp or the rain and all of these different kinds of things. It's all for string orchestra. So the rest of the orchestra gets a moment to rest, but it's one of the most colorful scores, and you get a couple chances to hear that shower scene music. And I have a feeling that that's one of the things that people will remember most from this program, because I conducted it for the first time yesterday, and it was kind of amazing. You know, I've never heard this live here in front of me, and it's powerful and dissonant and scary. So, yes, be ready. It might just bring you back.
Well, and then then we move on to another movie that has one scary scene as far as I'm concerned, and that's, of course, the horse head in the bed. And that's Nino Rota's The Godfather suite. And I think he was a child prodigy, I believe. And then he became very prolific with film scores and other music. Give us an overview of his film and other music, his collaborations with directors, and maybe the character of his music.
Yeah, and by the way, that horse head was a real horse head, and the actor wasn't expecting that. So those screams are kind of real. one of the most legendary scenes. By the way, is this the 15th that we're recording this?
I believe so, yes.
So 50 years ago today, this film was released.
Oh.
And we're not playing it in rehearsal today, so that's too bad. He worked, you know, a lot with a lot of the great Italian directors, Fellini and Visconti, and these people who cared a lot about music. Visconti, I think, did Death in Venice, which uses Mahler's Fifth constantly throughout. And so Rota was really considered himself a serious classical composer, and he was sort of in the vanguard of these. He dabbled in dodecaphonic music or 12-tone music, which was developed by Arnold Schoenberg. And so he wanted to be both in the super modern avant-garde school, but also be able to write for music, for films. It's funny when you think about that, because Godfather is full of these traditional sounding folk melodies. I think this score is the closest to Rachmaninoff of any of them on the program. He did, you know, the music for La Strada as well. He won the Academy Award for Best Score for this film. Then it was rescinded because they found out that he used the love theme actually in another movie. But he won it again for Godfather Part II, so he ended up getting one. But it sounds like Italy. It's got mandolins, it's got accordions, and a lone trumpet solo is how the score actually opens. It's got a tack piano, which we're not going to be using in this part of it, but it's the hammers sort of hit, I think, a piece of metal is how it works. And so
Oh,
it
really?
Sounds like this really percussive, rustic sounding. And he uses that in combination with a regular piano. So there are a lot of very interesting colors in the score, but the most memorable thing is the lush string melodies mm-hmm. that you're going to hear that really transport you to Italy.
Yeah, it's terrific music. And then next on the program is the symphonic variation Merry-Go-Round from Howl's Moving Castle. Now, I had not heard of that particular production, but by Joe Hisashi. I think I'm close on that. So familiarize us of who Hisashi, about Hisashi and his background, his musical style, and what this piece is all about.
Yeah, so I believe it's Joe Hisaishi, but the funny thing is close. Not his original name. His original name is a purely Japanese name, born in 1950. He's a big fan of Quincy Jones, and so it's a stage name. Quincy, in Japanese, the way that they say it, is very close to Hisaishi. So Joe is Jones. So he took his name from Quincy Jones, his stage name.
Oh, I see.
Now, some people don't know him, but he has a massive following. He, of course, has written a lot for the Studio Ghibli films, the director being Miyazaki, who also does the animation. It's incredible. Legions of fans in any given city. I guarantee you people are coming to this concert just for this one piece. And I've discovered it really this year. Of course, the most famous film is Spirited Away, but Howl's Moving Castle, which we're doing here, is another really famous one. I've seen probably five or six of these now, and the animation, the art is absolutely unparalleled. And Miyazaki is this guy who never rests. He's always drawing. He will never retire because he just loves doing it. And the films are so powerful. They're all they have a message either of environmentalism, or in the case of Howl's Moving Castle, it's an anti-war film, really. But they're all full of fantasy, and they all have some fantastical elements. But this film was inspired by Miyazaki's disgust or shock at the U.S.-Iraq war. So it's sort of an anti-war piece. Of course, it has nothing to do with Iraq. It's a fantastical kingdom that he's created. But the music for this is great. And Hisaishi is, it sounds a lot like a lot of these other European film composers. The most famous part of the score is this waltz, this merry-go-round theme, which sounds like it could be Nino Rota from The Godfather even. It's very lush writing. So this whole suite is about 14 minutes, and it's variations on this theme. And so the waltz becomes a march, or it becomes when they're riding off into battle on horses. And it's just a beautifully orchestrated thing. He also writes a lot for piano, and a lot of people in the world play his piano music because it's very accessible. It's not so terribly difficult to play. So I hope, I hope we've reached some Studio Ghibli fans out there. And Hisaishi, we did a show of his in Vancouver, and it sold out in like a day. So he's got a huge fan base, and I thought I would do it because it's not so often heard in the concert hall.
Okay, so we go from Merry-Go-Round to the finale from the Robin Hood Suite by Korngold. And Korngold has been described, and I'll read it here, the last gasp of the late Romantic spirit in Vienna. That's a mouthful. Familiarize us again, and I say again because someone else played some Korngold music earlier, with him and his music and his film scoring.
Yeah, I've learned it's a practical Korngold festival this year. There are three concerts in a row with Korngold, which never happens, but that's great because it's another underperformed composer. He was born in 1897 in Austria. He was an Austrian Jew, and so not a great time to be in your 30s and in Austria as a Jewish person, and things started getting quite bad, and the rise of Nazism there. He got an opportunity to come and score The Adventures of Robin Hood. So he crossed the Atlantic. And right at that time, before he left, the Nazis had seized his home. So he actually credits this opportunity with saving his life, because he thinks otherwise he wouldn't have crossed the Atlantic. He would have still been there, which is probably very true. But it's funny to think about that, because he, when he finally got to California, I guess, he saw the first cut of the film, and he asked to get out of it. He said, I'm a serious musician. I'm not an illustrator for a 90% action film, which this apparently, according to him, was. And yet he ended up doing it anyway. And this film has a lot of funny history because Errol Flynn apparently was very difficult to work with, cocky as all get out, which probably very much fits the characters he played, did not like to work with the director at all because one of them was married to the other one's ex, I think, and there was just a lot of tension there. A lot of complications in this film. So the biggest thing that sticks around is actually the score, and people just couldn't believe how glorious this music was. The other thing is the sound effect of the arrow is used all the time in the original Star Wars movies, but for spaceships, you know. So it's a very interesting film, but he did a lot of film scoring in the early days, but in his later life, he turned more towards operas and writing the violin concerto, which is going to be done here. But it is romantic music. It comes from that, you say the last gasp. I mean, that is the time in which that kind of style was becoming passé. So he kind of wrung it dry at that point. He used every last drop of that style. And we're only doing the finale and epilogue. So there's a battle at the very end, and then, of course, the triumphant ending and the classic sort of nostalgic, beautiful, dripping dulce string sound that you hear at the very end. So it's a great way to end the first half, and I think it's a good link to the Rachmaninoff, which comes in the second half, because it is romantic music.
Okay, so speaking of Rachmaninoff, it's the Piano Concerto number 2, and I read that Rachmaninoff dedicated this piece to a doctor, I guess following a rather rough time in his life. What is that all about?
Yeah, Dr. Dahl, D-A-H-L. So when Rachmaninoff wrote this piece, he was in a deep depression. He had premiered his first symphony, and it was a disaster. Glazunov was, I can't remember if he was conducting or if he was just there. He's a legendary composer who was known for writing critiques and being omnipresent at Petersburg concerts. And if you could get him there, that would be great. But you would hope that it turns out he would stuff his ears with cotton and just sit there and think about his own thoughts because he wanted to be polite and say yes, but he didn't really listen. So didn't go well. The orchestra was ill-prepared, which is probably a big part of the problem, but it was a disaster for Rachmaninoff. And he had a tender disposition, let's say, and it really hurt him a lot. And he fell into a big depression. He couldn't write anything for a very long time. He just felt terrible about himself, and so he didn't know what to do. He couldn't even go on as a performer. Finally, somebody recommended this guy, Nikolai Dahl, who lived down the street. He was a hypnotherapist as well as a psychiatrist, right? And these were in sort of the early days of hypnotherapy, which, I mean, mesmerism goes back even further, but to have it as part of clinical psychiatry. So he went into these sessions, and I think he went maybe once a day for 3 months, every day. Maybe it was Dahl that did it, maybe it was Rachmaninoff, but he ended up being entirely cured, and he wrote the second concerto, and it brought him out of this writer's block, and from then on, he was a star, and he never had problems writing, although he did take a very big break when he moved to America. He moved to California, like all the rest of these guys did. I just realized that now. That's another connection. Didn't really write for Hollywood, but so he dedicated this second concerto to this this doctor, for bringing him out of this depression.
Well, can you briefly describe this piece for us, and how did it find its way into Hollywood?
It has been used in a number of films. Brief Encounter by David Lean, is that right? And 7 Year Itch with Marilyn Monroe. Clint Eastwood has used it. And, of course, Eric Carmen's pop song All By Myself uses a bit of the melody. So, you know, it's just... I think it's very Hollywood sounding at times, and so it was very attractive to composers. But that's not at all, of course, what he was thinking about. Didn't really exist film music at the time. It was 1900, 1901. There's a lot to talk about in this piece. Rachmaninoff, you know, had a range of a 13th on a piano, which is an octave plus, right? A lot of pianists, most pianists, don't have that at all. So these pieces are a massive challenge because he wrote it for himself to play and to go around, and if he could play a 13th, then of course he's going to write that into his music. So very challenging, but of course it's standard repertoire for pianists. All of his concertos are full of melodies that are recognizable. It opens with piano alone, and you hear this constant low, I think it's an F, in the base of the instrument, which a lot of people consider to be the sound of Orthodox Russian bells that he would have grown up hearing. And it's one of the most haunting melodies, the opening. It's all in unison strings, and I often think of it as like a 1,000-person strong, you know, Soviet bass chorus, just a bunch of people singing at the top of their volume. And it's a gorgeous piece of music, and it has been used in a few films, maybe more than that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for being here, Andrew. You've been listening to a conversation with RSO Music Director finalist Andrew Krust. Tickets are still available for this concert, Rachmaninoff and the Hollywood Sound, which happens this Saturday, March 19th, 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. And be part of the choice. For tickets and more information, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson. Thank you for listening.